From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. CNN is the victor in round one of a legal battle with the Trump administration. This morning, a judge ordered the administration to reinstate reporter Jim Acosta's White House press pass. The White House had revoked it after the president and Acosta clashed in a press conference last week.
And tomorrow, President Trump visits victims of the California wildfires after seeming to blame the state for the damage from those fires. The death toll there continues to rise. The number of missing is well over 600. And of course, the Florida recount continues today. So let's convene our Friday politics roundtable. Joining us, Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor at Telemundo and NBC. He joins us from Miami. Hi, Jose.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Chad Pergram, he covers Congress for Fox News, joins us from Washington. Hi, Chad.
Thank you for having me.
Chad, I think your name has just been so relevant in the last couple weeks. I think of hanging Chads and the recount.
Oh, boy, here we go again.
But I do want to start, though.
Hanging Chads.
Hanging Chads. I want to start with the
card aggregate debris.
Yes. Anyway, I want to start, though, with this judge's decision, which, you know, came out just today, that CNN, you know, is claiming victory. But, Chad, your thoughts on that? Your network, Fox News, sided with CNN in this lawsuit. And the judge made his decision based on the Fifth Amendment, the right of due process, not the First Amendment.
And that's where, you know, there's going to have to be a written status report on this by Monday. We may see them back in court next week. But this temporary restraining order grants him access for the next couple of weeks here. And if you read the specific things that Judge Timothy Kelly said from the bench, I will grant the application for the temporary restraining order. I order the government reinstate the pass.
Yeah.
And so that's for now. But then, you know, it depends what happens later. And, you know, I have a little bit of personal experience with this. You know, I, for many years, worked. I was on the Radio TV Correspondents Association board here at the Capitol. It's a separate set of credentialing that we deal with up here. And so, you know, generally there has been allegiance between the RTCA and the White House Correspondents Association on these issues of access. But, you know, that's an issue that's come up here at the Capitol from time to time, maybe not as high profile, but it is an issue here about who gets in and when, you know, to have access to the Capitol and to government.
Well, Jose,
interesting that the judge was appointed by President Trump.
Right. But let me ask you, Jose, do you worry that since he made the decision on the Fifth Amendment right to due process, he said there wasn't really a process here. It was just, you know, finicky. Not the First Amendment right to free speech and press, that the White House could just come up with a process and then ban the same reporter.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they're even considering that, because this is, I think, plays right into President Trump's agenda. I think that the fact that he chose Jim Acosta during that news conference, knowing that Jim Acosta is a guy who asks very tough questions, is part of the process of Trump and his administration. You know, I remember that in July of 2015, when candidate Trump went to the borders of Laredo to tour, there was a, you know, press conference that he had just briefly there. I raised my hand. He knew who I was. He chose me first because he knew probably what I was going to ask him. And then he shut me down immediately. I think that this is, you know, the president's going to look for another way to continue this issue, because I think he really likes to be seen as confrontational with the press. And I think that's very dangerous.
Well, we'll see how that goes.
And let's turn to your elections now, just while we have time, because we could talk about the media, I think, forever probably, and what happens at the news conferences. The Republican in Florida, Ron DeSantis, looks like the winner in the governor's race. The Senate race is still being decided. Mark Walter, in a hearing yesterday, said this about the recount. He said, "We have been the laughingstock of the world, election after election, and we chose not to fix this." Jose, and then maybe Chad, how did we get here yet again?
You know, I'm a Florida resident, and I love Florida. I was born and raised in South Florida. I just can't figure out how it can be an embarrassment over and over and over again. 2000 was 18 years ago, and yet here we are today with a situation where we can't, you know, some voting places can't even hand in their ballots on time.
So, Chad, this is a live question. I mean, how does it happen?
Well, you know, there was a lot of criticism here from Capitol Hill, some bipartisan, but I remember Patrick Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, saying, you know, that they wanted to give more money to elections boards, you know, in local races and things, to be able to have better systems, to be able to tabulate the ballots more accurately. Some of that money went forth to try to protect the election. Some of that was because of pressure, maybe Russian meddling from the 2016 election. But there was more that people thought that should be done. And, you know, the Constitution, when it comes to federal office, you know, for House and Senate races, it says an issue of time, place, and manner. Manner, that's why you have different, you know, election times and methods of voting, you know, paper ballots, electronic voting, voting by mail. And when you defer that to the states, which the Constitution is pretty clear and explicit about, you're going to have different systems. And so that's why, you know, one state might do it really well. And here we are again with Florida.
Well, you know, others are saying we might have to have different expectations. It's not like the old days where you had election night. It is election night and then the days after where ballots come in because there's so many different things to be counted now. But what do you, I want to ask what you think, Chad, of the fact of how much our own leaders are dissing this system that makes us the pride of the world, you know, that we elect, freely elect our leaders.
And that's the irony. You know, how often do you see political leaders here, you know, former presidents? I know Jimmy Carter has done this a number of times, and even congressional leaders, where they go someplace overseas to be election monitors, some places having new elections. And yet here we are in Florida, you know, Porter County, Indiana had trouble.
Well, I'm saying, I mean, you know, with President Trump claiming that people are voting multiple times, getting back in their cars and changing and using disguises. Here's a minority leader, Chuck Schumer.
Mr. President, name one. Name a few. Where did it happen and when? Or did you just read this on some right-wing, nasty, dishonest blog and just repeat it?
And then we also have to add that this week, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, you know, some rumors about a presidential run for him, said that if the Georgia Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams doesn't win the governor's race there, it's because Republicans stole that election. I mean, the president has gone above and beyond with his criticism of the system that should be sacred. Is that damaging, Jose?
I think it's really damaging. I think that when you have the president and also political leaders say things like that without one shred of evidence, it damages. It damages this system, which with all of its flaws is still, no doubt, the best system in the world for representative democracy.
We should mention that California Congressman Kevin McCarthy was elected this week to lead Republicans in the House, and he had a warning for his fellow members of the GOP.
We took a beating inside the suburban areas. We're going to have to work harder. I think our message is going to have to be clearer. Our ideas are going to have to be stronger. We realize that, and we will work towards that effort.
90% of Republicans in the upcoming Congress are white men, and there's debate within the GOP over why they lost. Conservatives say that they didn't do what they promised, for instance, building a wall. I wonder what you both think of this. Jose, you first.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think that what is the unsung story here is the Latino vote in 2018. And the fact is that, you know, every month in this country, 66,000 U.S.-born Latinos turn 18 years of age. And when they get mobilized and they decide to register and vote, it's going to change things. And you want to talk about getting beaten. Look at how the Latinos voted in Texas, for example. A very, very close race for Senator Cruz. And I think the closeness was, among other things, because of the young Latino vote.
And to add to Jose's point there, it's not so much just the Latino vote in Texas or Florida or someplace else, but it was the fact that you had Latinos and Democratic votes in the suburbs, in red states. Look at who lost in Texas. John Culberson, a Republican from suburban Houston. Look at Pete Sessions, the chairman of the Rules Committee, who lost in suburban Dallas. You certainly saw that in Northern Virginia, Barbara Comstock losing. The fact that in most cases, Virginia is not a red state, but that Democrats were able to get into those suburbs in red states and red areas, that's the real problem for the Republican Party in the long term. And you certainly saw it play in Texas.
Chad Pergram, we just saw it in Orange County, California last night. Late results, the Democrat Katie Porter declared the winner over the two-term Republican Mimi Walters. That means Democrats have captured three out of the four congressional seats in that, you know, this is Reagan country. And they're saying a fourth still undecided race there could also go Democratic. So there's your point.
Yeah, that's precisely it. And that's why the Democrats did so well. And keep in mind why they did well in those areas. Some of it was because of the tax plan. something that they moved through Congress, not really popular in some quarters in California, yet Republicans in the House voted for it. And again, there was the Trump backlash. Mm-hmm. President Trump has generally not been very popular in the suburbs. And it was this fealty on behalf of some Republicans in Congress, you know, kind of kowtowing to the president, maybe not doing appropriate oversight. People who were opposed to him then got on board once he got elected. That kind of turned against those Republicans in those suburban districts.
And in California, Jeff Denham, the congressman, lost there. Republican, pro-immigration reform, really been fighting on that, and he lost.
Okay, we just want to make one last note. We got less than a minute here. Elvis is among the Americans receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Trump today, joining Babe Ruth, Utah Republican Orrin Hatch, the last Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the late, rather, Supreme Court Justice, and Miriam Adelson, the philanthropist wife of Trump donor and casino magnate Sheldon Adelson. We're getting a sense of where President Trump wants to honor Americans, and it gives us a chance to play Elvis. Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor at Telemundo and NBC. Chad Pergram, Fox News senior.
Let's get Kachow a Medal of Freedom. Kachow, creator of the Mambo.
Chad, Jose, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good Thanksgiving.
Thanks.
You
thanks.
Too.
This is Here and Now.
Tomorrow will be too late. It's not.
The holiday season is coming, and that means food. Maybe a little double dipping. Maybe a few things fall on the floor, like the entire top of a cake. That happened to producer Karen once. But hey, scoop it up. 5-second rule. Well, for that thinking, we apparently have Genghis Khan to thank. In the 1100s, he thought his food was so special, of course it could be eaten off the floor. And then Julia Child backed him up. She ate anything that fell. But now two food scientist microbiologists have put that and other theories about food safety to the test. Their book is Did You Just Eat That? Two scientists explore double dipping, the 5-second rule, and other myths in the lab. Dr. Paul Dawson joins us from Clemson University. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
And also Professor Brian Sheldon. He's a professor emeritus at North Carolina State University. He's in Winston-Salem. Professor Sheldon, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we want to start by saying this is not for the faint of heart, this book, because you point out right at the beginning, bacteria outnumber us. We're each carrying about 4 pounds.
That's correct. Basically, the bacterial cells, viral cells, et cetera, microorganism cells far outnumber the number of cells we actually have in our body. And for the most part, these organisms actually do a lot of good things, but then again, there are organisms that can cause foodborne illnesses or other types of illnesses.
And it only takes a small amount of the bad kind. Dr. Dawson, what are we talking about there? I mean, something that really can be dangerous for you.
Norovirus, the causes of virus, salmonella, campylobacter, E. coli, they're in the news all the time. 1 in 6 Americans get foodborne illness a year. Then there's bacteria like Listeria that actually can grow in refrigerated temperatures. So there's a few that are bad players.
Well, and let's get at how bad they can be. Take that 5 seconds thing. You point out things that can happen in 5 seconds. You can blink your eyes 15 to 20 times. The Earth moves about 95 miles orbiting the sun. But truly, can something happen to a piece of food on the floor in 5 seconds?
Yes. Bacteria almost immediately attach to food if they're on that surface and food comes in contact with it. So, yeah, a lot can happen.
Let's just say we hope people aren't eating at this moment. Explain further. A floor can even look clean. It can even have just been washed, but it might have been washed by a disgusting mop. And the floor, we're reminded, is where people walk who might have been out on a sidewalk, where animals do their thing. I mean, you know, your floor is traipsed over.
Yeah, and I think we talk about the pounds of, again, it's not time for lunch, but pounds of dog feces that are dropped each year. So the odds are there probably won't be a pathogen there, but there always could be. Microorganisms, and obviously they're called microorganisms because we can't see them, they can survive days or weeks. In the study we've done, this studies and other studies, that you leave bacteria or inoculate a surface with bacteria and then leave it to dry, that they can survive days or weeks. So if someone has cut raw meat or some contaminated food on the surface and then leaves and you follow them and put food there to make a sandwich, then you're going to pick that up.
And by the way, when you say inoculating, you don't mean inoculating against. You
no,
mean
I'm
you're
sorry.
Giving.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mean you're giving yourself something.
I'm using it in a negative
right.
way.
Blowing out birthday candles, Dr. Sheldon, really that can spread bacteria on the cake.
Well, basically, every time that we breathe, we are actually emitting bioaerosols, very small droplets, and these droplets can carry microorganisms, flu virus, bacteria, tuberculosis organisms. In our study, we came up with the scenario that you had a 90-year-old grandmother who was celebrating her birthday and asked for the assistance of her grandchildren in blowing out these candles. So you can imagine just the number of organisms that could be spread by just the simple practice of blowing out birthday candles.
Well, we don't have to imagine because you've done the research. The average blowing out of candles increases bacteria by 2,700 bacteria on a cake. If it's a sloppy candle blower, it's increased by 37,000, 12,000% increase of the bacteria in the cake. So that's gross. Here's another one. We think about this a lot, drying your hands with paper towels or with the air dryers.
Just like we talked about blowing birthday candles out, the same thing would apply to a hand dryer or blower in a bathroom. Just by flushing a toilet, you're emitting bioaerosols from the toilet or urinal. You compound that by sticking your hands under a hand dryer.
Why is it dirtier from a dryer? We understand 35% less bacteria is found on hands that were paper towel dried, and there's a 504 increase in total bacteria on fingertips after drying with the automatic dryers. Why would that be?
We actually tested not only the air coming out, we put a petri dish underneath where the air came out. We also tested the push buttons as well as the intake. So it could be that someone pushes a button before they dry their hands or wash their hands. You can imagine that's inoculating the surface there. So that might be one reason. Also, bacteria form biofilms. So actually dislodging or rubbing them, that might be a way that you're getting more bacteria off with a towel than you are a hand blower.
Oh, so you're actually taking the bacteria off with the towel.
And of course, most of these hand dryers, they have an incoming vent. They don't traditionally, or probably are not getting clean very often, and therefore they accumulate organisms and dust. And every time you cycle on the hand dryer, you are also basically taking that dust and that dirt and those organisms and propelling it out the exit vent.
But does either matter if you then turn around and pull open the bathroom door by the handle?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I usually use a paper towel to open the door.
And then throw it out, you know, in a garbage
outside,
can.
Yeah.
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 Okay, double dipping. Anyone who watches Seinfeld knows it's impolite.
Did you just double dip that chip?
Excuse me?
You double dipped the chip.
Double dipped? What are you talking about?
You dipped the chip. You took a bite. And you dipped again.
So
that's like putting your whole mouth right in the dip.
You're biting the chip off and sticking it back in the dip. You're actually inoculating the dip with your oral bacteria. Salsa actually had more bacteria transferred than did cheese fondue or chocolate dip. And when you think about it, it's common sense because salsa is much thinner. So more inoculated salsa, if you will, is dropping back off the cracker or chip back into the common bowl than with the other two.
I mean, now that we're thoroughly going to be avoiding the office parties, have you been able to trace an illness back to somebody double dipping or somebody, you know, a cake?
We're looking at probabilities of things occurring. Mm. It comes down to what types of organisms are there. If there are food pathogens there, such as Salmonella, Campylobacter, Listeria, you name it, they have to be there in a certain population. Mm. And then it also comes down to how virulent those organisms are. There are some that require very few organisms to get sick, whereas a normal human adult who has a good immune system, it may take thousands.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you really could get sick from every time you ate something off the floor with the 5-second rule, we'd all be on gurneys right now. But, you know, you're leading on the side of caution here.
Yes.
So let's do that with restaurants. The experiments you did were in the realm of menus, ice, and lemon. Start with menus. Paul Dawson, stunning. Menus can have more bacteria than toilet seats?
Well, that's one of the studies that we cited. In our study, we looked at random sample of menus as well as transfer of bacteria from hands to menus in an inoculated study in our lab. And yeah, randomly we found significant numbers of bacteria on menus. Everyone virtually handles a menu. People can handle them, sneeze on them, cough on them.
Okay.
And so.
But it just starts to feel disgusting when you think about ice. 3,500 samples of ice used in restaurants in drinks, 9% contaminated with coliforms, 11% had huge bacterial counts. In 2017, iced coffee drinks from Starbucks and Cafe Nero had fecal bacteria. Mm-hmm. But you're not saying don't drink the coffee from Starbucks. What are you saying?
What we're saying is that it comes back to the practices of these food handlers. Are they, in fact, washing their hands properly, sanitizing when they need to, preventing cross-contamination in their kitchens? When they pick up the ice, are they using their hands? Or are they using tongs? How clean are the tongs? Is the ice machine receiving a periodic cleaning and sanitation?
Okay. Oh, and staying with drinks, when it comes to the lemon slices in them, you say, just watch how many things the bartender touches. Look, that dirty rag wiping down the bar. And then he gets the lemon slice for your drink and puts it in with his bacteria. So a caution there. Real quick, sharing popcorn in the movie theater, passing that bucket around. What could go wrong, Paul Dawson?
Well, there's a couple things that could go wrong. In our study, we found that actually when you stick your hand in the popcorn and stick it in your mouth and then stick it back in the popcorn bag, you're transferring your oral bacteria back to the bag. I think the bigger problem is that surfaces are fairly contaminated, movie theaters, handrails, seats. And so I think the danger would be touching that surface and then actually putting your hand in the bag and sticking that popcorn in your mouth. You're kind of inoculating yourself with something you don't know.
Right.
One scientist was interviewed, and he suggested that you keep one good hand in the movie theater. In other words, you don't touch anything with one hand, and that's the one you eat popcorn with.
Yeah. Oh, boy, that's a lot to think about. You've also got lists of other tips, from cooking temperatures to proper washing techniques. And by the way, Paul, weigh in. Where do you come down on the antibacterial hand washes and counter wipes? Some people feel we're killing too much bacteria, but you say what?
There's a lot of bacteria, and there's been multiple studies where you clean a surface or you wash something and you go back and there's still bacteria there. So hand washing is what actually been proven to be better than alcohol sanitizers, but antimicrobials in addition to that are good. I don't think your hands could be too clean, in other words.
Well, I have to tell you both, Dr. Paul Dawson of Clemson University and Professor Brian Sheldon of North Carolina State, after looking at your book, we want to bathe in antibacterial cleanser. Paul, Brian, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you very much.
And our director, Mark, just said, that whole thing was disgusting. So let's continue it. Your thoughts on unsafe foods, welcome here and now.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The FDA announced this week that it's looking to ban menthol cigarettes and to limit teens' access to flavored e-cigarettes like Juuls, with growing concerns over new tobacco use by young adults, some of it related to vaping. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, we know the FDA has been concerned about these e-cigarettes with flavors like mango and cream for a while. Teen smoking rates have fallen 36% over the last two decades, but e-cigarette use is up 77%. So first, tell us more about what the new restrictions on e-cigarettes would be.
Well, it really goes to, as you said, the flavored products. The FDA is not actually banning the flavors, but they do want to restrict the sales of most types of these flavored products to specialized vaping stores that really check IDs, and also online retailers who take efforts to verify a purchaser's age. Again, really just trying to keep them out of the hands of kids.
Well, but teens can end run that. And there was an expectation that the FDA was going to do a complete ban. Some Congress members sent out press releases praising this ban, which didn't happen.
It's really interesting. FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb's statement on this is it's very personal and very detailed. And he discusses a sort of balancing act that the agency is trying to perform, because there's obviously reason to believe that e-cigarettes and vaporizers are helpful and less dangerous for adults who are trying to quit actual cigarettes. But what Gottlieb is worried about is that the prevalence of these devices, he's worried this will cause big chunks of the younger generations to get addicted to nicotine. And then obviously some will move on to more traditional and more dangerous cigarettes. So he's trying to really nip that trend in the bud.
Well, and the FDA does want to ban a third of the cigarettes that are sold in the U.S. These are menthols, and they've been trying to do this for years. The thinking is that they disproportionately harm African Americans, since 81% of African American smokers use them, only 29% of white smokers. And this people trace back to the 70s. We remember those menthol ads in African American neighborhoods, you know, with slogans like "Cool ain't cold, Newport is." I mean, the African Americans were targeted by the sellers of menthol cigarettes. And some African American leaders are in favor of the NAACP, but the Reverend Al Sharpton spoke out against the ban. He said it's going to just produce another way for police to harass African Americans if they have menthols.
Right. And Gottlieb, again, is targeting this at children mostly. He's saying that the menthol serves to mask some of the sort of unattractive flavors of smoking that otherwise might discourage young kids from taking it up. And, you know, he believes from their study of the issue that it's one of the most common and pernicious routes by which kids begin smoking actual cigarettes. And he does actually address the racial issue specifically, saying that exactly what you're talking about, the exaggerated use among the African-American community really exacerbates disparity in health issues related to race and socioeconomic status. So he really is more or less siding with the NAACP, and he's trying to alleviate that issue to some degree.
Wait, interesting news from the FDA this week. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Poetry is often written to be read aloud, to savor the sounds and rhythms. The Grammy-winning jazz musician Luciana Souza takes things a step further and puts her favorite poetry to music, as she does in her newly released album, The Book of Longing.
My angel's upset, but I'm not allowed a trace of regret, for someone will use.
Luciana Souza's album features songs she wrote to the poetry of artists including Leonard Cohen. When she writes the music, she doesn't listen to Cohen's own recitations. She finds a way to make the words her own.
So what I do is that I memorize the poem, and then I walk around, driving, walking literally through the supermarket, and I just speak the words. And then eventually a rhythm comes. But I try to do it not by scanning the poem like you would do in a poetry class, you know, and finding the foot and the meter and all that stuff. Because music is different. You do have measures, and it happens in time. But song is different. It has to sound like a song. So then I start to just kind of derive the rhythm from it naturally. And then inevitably I either sit at the piano or grab a guitar or a percussion instrument, and then a groove comes. Or a note kind of speaks louder. Or I look at the words and I say, this has to feel like something that's resolving from tension to resolution.
I built my house beside the wood so I could hear you singing. And it was sweet and it was good and love was all beginning. Fare thee well, my nightingale, 'twas long ago I found you. Now all your songs of beauty fail, the forest closes round you.
When you're using the words of Leonard Cohen or Emily Dickinson or Edna St. Vincent Millay, how large do those characters loom for you? I mean, you know, I would imagine somebody like Leonard Cohen, whom you knew, would be honored to have you put music to one of his poems. But I wonder for you, does their legacy loom large? Is there ever a feeling of needing to really honor them? Or do you see it much more as a collaboration?
With Leonard, my previous record, I had set two of his poems to music, and I did ask him. And He said no three times, just like a good Jewish man would do, you know. Can I? No. Can I? Please? No. And the third time, okay. And then he heard
good
the pieces.
Good for you for being insistent.
Well, I know about that. But the poetry doesn't need me. Leonard clearly doesn't need me to set anything of his to music, and neither does, you know, the dead Edna St. Vincent Millay or Christina Rossetti or Emily Dickinson. But it's more about the responsibility of setting this poem. Has anyone else done it before? So I do some kind of research. And then if I feel like I still have something else I want to say about this, this is not the right music. I need to write my own music for this thing. And these are now my words. So it's really about taking possession. That's how I feel about it. And it becomes mine.
The sun goes down behind a veil. 'Tis now that you would call me. So rest in peace, my nightingale, beneath a branch of holly. Fare thee well, my nightingale, I live but to be near you. Though you are singing somewhere still, I can no longer hear you.
So talk about one of your own compositions. There are three here that you wrote the poetry to and the music.
My poetry is really very simple, but it's almost list-like. You know, I write a word, and then that calls in another word and another word. It's not narrative.
The sea grows dark, the rising tide, like a prophet at dusk, you wait.
It's almost like, because I come from bossa nova, which is really, it sort of dictates everything in my life, bossa nova is more like a picture. It's not like a movie that with time and progression and narrative. It's really about looking at a photograph and describing it. So I think my poetry is like bossa nova in a way. And then when you listen to my music, it is bossa nova. So I never have left.
These are the days of long, long nights. These are the tables we set out to feast. These are the flags we wave. These are the flags we wave.
Since you have worked with the poetry of Elizabeth Bishop in the past, Pablo Neruda, and Emily Dickinson here, and Edna St. Vincent Millay to Leonard Cohen, how would you approach, say, Edna St. Vincent Millay differently than you would Pablo Neruda?
Neruda, without knowing that he's Chilean, his music for me, his poetry for me, became music that was all in 3-4. And then when I started thinking about it, Brazilian music is mostly binary, it's mostly in 2, but Neruda's rhythm was all in 3, and the Spanish language for me is very much in 3-4. So then the whole record is in 3 and 6 and multiples of that, you know? And one interesting thing that happened on this record is when I was trying to set the Emily Dickinson, which my husband had gifted me a book, which he does often, and I'm so grateful for that. But he brought a big new edition, Harvard Press, of all these sort of annotated, sort of the kosher version of everything, like everything is in there. And I came across one that was numbered 419, and I called it We Grow Accustomed to the Dark, because that's the first line of the poem. And that one is all free form. It has no rhyme, and so the rhythm didn't come to me very clearly, but then I sort of imposed sort of a rock feel to it, which is so antithetical to everything I do. I mean, I'm not a rock and roll person, but it just felt so right, so grounding.
We grow accustomed to the dark. When light is put away is when the neighbor holds the lamp to witness her goodbye.
But again, Lisa, I kind of fall in love and then I become obsessed. And nothing else matters. There's no dinner. There's no picking up at school. There's just the poem. You know?
A moment we uncertain step. For newness of the night, then fit our vision to the dark and meet the road erect. And so star come out within.
When you approach a subject in an album like this, you call it the Book of Longing. The idea of longing or yearning, is that something that you approach differently with age? That you now have a son, you've been in the business a long time, and hopefully have many, many more albums to come. What does maturity have to do with this?
Oh, I think it has a lot. I've told people recently that this is my most important record, and I don't know if it's because it is my last one, and I don't mean this in a sad way.
Latest one.
It's my latest one, but it may be my last one. I mean, making records is a hard thing nowadays, and I'm not questioning my need to make art. I will always write, and I'll always be at home making music and singing, but producing, promoting, presenting this project, will I do another one? I don't know. And so this record feels final in a way that it is the most important thing I've done so far in my life, and I think it unites everything. I think it's me coming very much clean and open and empty. And the longing, the idea of longing is, it permeates everything I do because I've left a country many times. I've left Brazil many times. I've left people. I've lost my parents. I've lost friends. And so I'm okay also going to this place of sadness. I feel like we avoid it, but it's such a part of life and it brings so much of my humanity forward. This is what I want when I perform. This is what I want when I write music, when I sing live in front of people. I want us all to commune, and I want to be able to show this part of myself that I know lives in all of us, and hopefully it can touch and soothe people.
That's the part you have to remember when your fans say, please don't make this your last album.
Of course. No, I already have another one that I'm thinking about.
Excellent. Luciana Souza, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For if the darkness and corruption leave a vestige of the thoughts that once I had.
Brazilian musician and poet Luciana Souza. Her new album is called The Book of Longing. She's currently on tour and will be in California and New Mexico later this month. For a link to her website, go to hereandnow.org.
So, when was the last time you got your teeth cleaned? Sorry for the guilt trip, but the American Dental Association says the number of working-age adults getting dental care in recent years has been declining, and the industry is looking for ways to turn that around and adapt to a changing economy. Here now is Peter O'Dowd reports.
This is not what you would expect to hear from a glitzy office space overlooking Boston's skyline.
Yes, we're in a conference room.
Debbie Kenny works for a company called Virtudent.
Because that's where we find it's easy for people to take care of their oral health.
There is a black curtain that's splitting the room to give people some privacy, and you've got a full-blown operation going on here. Can we see it?
Yeah. Come over here.
Hi.
She set up shop today with two dental hygienists. They're working at the offices of EF, a business that promotes cultural education and travel around the world. Employee Maria De Lorenzo is staring straight up at the ceiling. She's a good sport in a vulnerable position.
No, I've never been interviewed getting my teeth cleaned or laying down.
For the most part, this is a typical cleaning, except the hygienist takes pictures of De Lorenzo's teeth with a portable camera. A dentist will review them later, and the patient will get a note to follow up if there's a problem.
Why do you do this at work?
It is so much more convenient. I actually moved to Boston about a year and a half ago from Southern Maine, so my dentist office is still there. And rather than trying to find somebody for the annual checkups and whatnot, it's easier to do it here, and then being able to book on site for the upcoming months is also super helpful.
Were you one of those people who hadn't been to the dentist in a while?
I usually made it once a year. Now I go twice.
And that is exactly the point. Virtudent operates in unlikely places like this conference room to reach people who wouldn't otherwise go to the dentist.
It is really difficult to access dental care for 40% of Americans.
Hitesh Tolani is the dentist who founded Virtudent, and he's armed with statistics from the American Dental Association.
The other issue is that a number of Americans between 19 and 64 have stopped going to the dentist.
Sound familiar?
They call it America's, you know, dental busyness problem.
Why? Because they're busy, not because they're afraid or they're having trouble paying for it or they don't have insurance. It's because they're busy?
It's a combination of all these things, right? Mm-hmm. People aren't going either because there's a whole study on this. They think it's too expensive. Many of those people who think it's too expensive actually don't understand their insurance benefit. Others are, you know, they think they're healthy. A lot of people have gum disease, right? So that doesn't hurt, essentially. And then 33% of the people aren't going are not going because of inconvenience. Hmm. And this busyness problem I'm talking about is that dentists are actually having empty chair time, right? Like there's a need and then they have empty chairs.
So Virtudent brings the suction to the people. The company has served up to 4,000 patients at big businesses like Athena Health and smaller startups. Revenue helps Talani set up separate clinics for low-income children.
Dentistry is going through a true metamorphosis of different delivery models.
Roger Levin is a Maryland-based consultant and a dentist himself.
The concept of an organization that would create dental services at the location of an employer of a large company or a mid-sized company does make sense, and we are seeing several examples of those emerging in different parts of the United States.
And it's not the only way dentists are rethinking business as usual. Levin says the 2008 recession started the upheaval when private equity swooped in to rescue troubled practices. That's contributed to the rise of the DSO.
Which stands for dental support organizations, often referred to as corporate dentistry.
Now hundreds of dentists can be housed under one corporate roof. It relieves some of the administrative pressure of managing a private practice. And today, Levin says 20% of dentists get a paycheck from a DSO. Here's another issue.
The average dentist graduates with $300,000 of debt unless they go to a for-profit school where they're coming out over $400,000 in debt.
Which means young dentists can't afford to build a traditional practice by themselves. It's even tougher because insurance companies are reimbursing less.
You know, like many business industries, we're in a rapid pace of change and many people are trying to figure out where it's going.
Which is how we ended up hearing this sound inside the conference room overlooking Boston's skyline. And there's one other thing worth noting. Getting your teeth cleaned at work isn't just about the economics of dentistry. It also says something about the American economy. Employers are competing for workers in a tight job market, and it's not enough anymore to reward those workers with a paycheck.
We try to help out as well as much as we can to make sure all of our staff, frankly, are both happy and healthy.
EF North America CEO Edward Holt says he brings perks like Virtudent to his conference rooms to boost his company's culture.
Dentist cleaning and eye exams, flu shots, being able to cut your hair here. These are all things that we all need to do.
Wait, you can get your hair cut here?
You can get your hair cut here, yeah. Yeah, so, and it's really about, that part is about stress management.
And that may have a happy side effect. Preventing gingivitis or a root canal. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Rodak.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.